Today's guests on the podcast are Gus Pollard and Rich Davis. I caught up with the guys back in May 2018 during their handover phase at the 10 Cases. We get to hear their wine origin stories. We talk education. And each of them chooses a wine for us to taste. Enjoy.
Hi guys, I'm Gus. Thanks Lawrence for having us on the show today. My wine journey started when I was born a long time ago, back in Australia. So I'm from a town called Bannockburn or Geelong, just outside of Melbourne. I was born into a family of parents who both were already working in the wine trade, which was incredibly, I'm very fortunate for, and I was very, I'm always very, very thankful for that. So I actually grew up running around the vines as a kid. Climbing on pallets of wine and running around the winery, which was great. So before I actually knew anything about wine, I was around it. So my mum runs a winery called Bannockburn Vineyards, which was started by my grandfather, and my dad is a wine importer. So he imports a lot of Burgundian focused wine, but also German bits from Piemonte and various other bits from around the world, but focused on French and Burgundian specifically. So that was great, but I, as I grew up, I did what most silly young kids do, and took to drinking vodka and Red Bull and carrying on with that sort of thing for a while. And then around the age of 20, I actually realised that wine was something I wanted to be serious about, and I had a defining bottle with my father, which was a Munro Gibor Echizo. No, sorry, it was a Clos Vougeot 2002, and it was just a stunning wine that made me stand up and take notice and think that this was actually something. I'd currently been attempting university business degrees and arts degrees, which I'd been failing at, and I'd never felt attached to. So I decided that I wanted to take the wine thing a little bit more seriously. So I moved to Melbourne, got a job in, at the time, one of the more serious wine bars in the city, and a bit of an institution called the Melbourne Supper Club, and that was where it all started. So great exposure to wines of the world there. And that's started my journey more seriously. I've been in London for the last 5 years. I have been with the 10 Cases as the general manager and wine buyer for the last four and a bit years. And I will be returning to Australia in the next couple of months to continue the journey over there.
Yeah. Hi guys, I'm Richard. I'm currently in the handover stage from Gus, who you've just heard from. I wasn't born into a wine dynasty like Gus was. I was brought up on the more sort of supermarket wines that my parents would quaff. But I sort of always had a desire to work in the hospitality trade. I think my dad can vouch for that I wanted to own and run a beach bar in the south of France. I haven't quite got there yet, but still working on it. But I, like most sort of middle-class British people, British teenager, was destined or thought they were destined to go and work in finance or somewhere where you'd earn lots of money very quickly. But after not getting into university, but planning on taking a gap year, started working in a local bar, which was wonderfully unprofessional. But it was a great sort of little start into it, and had bags loads of fun, worked, made some really great friends. And yeah, sort of haven't looked back since. Opened Bar Balloud as a sort of junior waiter, and sort of worked myself up to assistant restaurant manager. Then moved to Paris for reasons that will not be shared in this podcast. And after that didn't go so well. Ended up staying there for a year and worked at a place called Saturn, which sort of sort of brought back my love of wine, and just surrounded by people where you just were constantly opening bottles and learned so much. And that was my sort of true education, is just, and the way that I like to learn is just by getting stuck into a bottle, than doing academic theory, sort of classroom based work. When I came back from Paris, did a little stint at between Terroir and Braun, and that was only for 6 months, and then I joined Brasserie Zadel in not a wine role at all. Maitre d' there for a couple of years, and then I joined Segrim Wild and worked under Michael, creating the wine list at Paradise Row, that at the time had been slightly sort of neglected. I think, you know, collectively we've all done a pretty good job on that. But then hearing the news that Gus was heading back to Australia and was just and to take over at 10 Cases, just a job I couldn't turn down, and just be able to put my print on the scene in London was too difficult to turn up. So yeah, 3 weeks in, it's a lot of fun with Gus, and it's a shame he's going back.
So I neglected a couple of years there in that opening little introduction, which is going to explain a little bit there. So I actually diverted into a nightclub bar as soon as I had finished school. What started out as a part-time job ended up being a little bit more full-time in a management position of a nightclub. Very late nightclub as well, and then I really enjoyed that energy, like behind the bar. So I was still in the phase of not taking wine quite as serious as I should have been, but I really enjoyed the energy of that part of hospitality and that high energy bar style environment.
Okay, yeah.
So after that, when I finally made the move to Melbourne in the wine bar, we had that, a component of that. But I also wanted to learn a bit more about spirits and beers and cocktails and the whole beverage industry, which I still have a huge passion for. So I actually, after that initial wine bar, the supper club, I moved to a cocktail-focused bar, which still had a really good wine offering, but cocktails was the focus, and high-end cocktails. And I did that for about a couple of years and moved into a bar management position there. And it was fantastic because I actually met one of my mentors through this role, David Lawler, who was at the time the beverage director of the Rockpool Restaurant Group. So working with him on the wine side of things, but learning from fantastic bartenders on the cocktail side of things, really sort of rounded out my experience. That was a great little point, but it also brought me back on the wine path eventually. And that was my last job working for the Rockpool Group before coming to the UK. I have always managed to stay in roles for quite a long time, which is really important to me. I don't want to jump around too much. I think you really need to start to embody your place of employment. For me, it's always been really important to give it a good crack and really, really, really try and settle in. And I still believe in that. So, yeah, okay. I guess I've always tried to stay in roles for a decent amount of time.
So, Richard, I mean, from your story there, the thing that really comes out for me was the whole thing about learning by experience and learning by practice. And I can 100% relate to that, you know, not being from a hugely, you know, wine influenced background, and learning from interviewing people and learning from just hearing stories and that. So it's just not really a question, but, you know, could I just ask you to reflect on that and I guess how that's enabled you to develop across your career?
The whole thing about education in wine, it's just not, I don't think, a one-size-fits-all. You know, again, you go back to growing up in the schools in the UK where it's basically the exams are regurgitating the knowledge that you've read in a book or in a class and just put that down on your exam paper. And I wasn't particularly good at that. I didn't put a lot of effort into it also between the ages of 14 and 18. which sort of probably led me to this career slightly easier than I found this career slightly easier. But yeah, I mean, for some people going and doing your quartermasters or your WSET exams, that's the way, that's the best way for them to learn. I don't think it helps me. I much prefer to sit round with people a lot more knowledgeable than I am and drink a bottle and understand and the stories and the tangents that goes off, whether it's talking about a region or a certain soil type, I understand that when I can see the end product of it, than going and drawing pictures of Anjou or Saumur or something like that. I can profess I haven't visited nearly enough winemakers and regions that I would like to. But that I'm a lot more sort of, I learn by touch and feel, not by reading.
I have to agree wholeheartedly with that from Rich. And I feel that's the same for me. It takes me back to that profound bottle that I was talking about with my father. And I'm pretty sure within that conversation, he said, in order to learn great wine, you have to drink great wine. You can't just taste it or you can't just read about it. You have to drink it. You have to get your wallet out and pay some money and have a great bottle with people you love and talk about it and share it. And that's how you learn. That's really how you learn. And that's how I've learned. I'm the same. I've done a couple of levels of WSET back when I was 18, 19, and I didn't really connect with it at all either. I think that getting out there and travelling and drinking great wines with like-minded people and discuss, or not always like-minded actually, sometimes it's good to have a discussion with someone who doesn't have the same outlook. That's for me the best way to learn. I would never say that you shouldn't follow the path of slightly more academic knowledge, but I just believe that you should do what feels right to yourself. Yeah. So first one we're going to have a little look at today is we're going to taste and drink on this occasion and talk about it. Here at the 10 Cases, we are exposed to a huge array of styles, varietals, regions, countries. We try to cover the whole world, and we have that flexibility with the short bistro list of highly rotating wines which aren't repeated, and everything available by the glass, and then the more classic and conventional cav wine list. So it's a fantastic opportunity to look at things from many, many places, and we're very proud of that, and it makes the role of wine, well, makes working here a pleasure, but it makes the wine buying role probably one of the more fun wine buying roles. Today I wanted to choose something that I had a bit of a personal connection with, and it's a wine from Australia. It's from Akota Barrels. So Taras and Amber Akota, who I've met a couple of occasions. And I really love their ethos when it comes to producing wines. They work out of predominantly the Adelaide Hills, a little bit in Barossa as well, Eden. And they have been inspired by many wines, many regions and wines of the world. But they try to create very honest, minimal intervention wines from their little plots. So the one that we're drinking today is a very summery red. It's called Texture Like Sun. So apart from the fact that they're both very lovely people, they make beautiful wines. They also like to incorporate musical influences into many of their cuvée names, and many I particularly have an affination with. So I'm a big fan of The Cure and Dead Kennedys and bands like that. So Texture Like Sun's from Strangler's track. And it really suits this wine. It's a field blend with predominantly Grenache, Pinot Noir, pardon me, Merlot, and a little splash of Gewurz. But I think that varies from vintage to vintage. And it's destemmed, but whole berry and a lot of solids, so it's very textural. It's best served chilled, light extraction, really, really vibrant and fresh, and it's got that real crunchy cranberry and wild strawberry vibrancy about it. I, for me, on a warm summer's day, we're currently sitting in a basement, so we can't see the sun, but this is bringing some summery atmosphere to the room right now. So
I'm going to leave what you said about the wine, but I just want to pick up, Gus. Sorry, Lawrence, I'm doing your job here. you sort of touched on the ethos of 10 cases, and, you know, having seen what you've done here for the 4 years, I think it was one of the big reasons that sort of sparked that initial interest and, right, I'm going to take a conversation with these guys. You know, it's very much Gus's 10-case wine list, I think, at the moment. And, you know, when we've sat down and drank, we've sort of found that we like pretty similar things with a slight sort of, you know, of course there's going to be some differences. That's not to say that the wine list is going to stay the same. I think, you know, I have some producers that I like slightly more than other producers, or, you know, regions that I love to highlight and get behind. A lot gets talked about that. I think, you know, when people open wine bars or wine focused places, we have a natural wine list, or we have a classical wine list. And I don't think that has to be the case. You know, some of the best wines in the world that don't propose themselves as natural wines are a lot more natural than a lot of other wines that are said to be natural. I mean, natural is, I think, one of the worst terms and definitions for minimal intervention wine. I think that sort of fits the bill a lot better. But yeah, I mean, what me and Gus, I think, will always agree on is what it matters what's in the glass, whether it is a really simple question, whether it is good or not good. And I think that's all that matters. And generally, the wines that I find are the best are the ones where they're not spraying chemicals all over the place and dousing everything with sulfites, because they lack that purity and that energy that you do get from having that slight sort of hands-off approach. But it's knowing when to take your hands off and knowing when to put your hands on, I think, really matters. Not that I've ever made wine in my life, but...
So I really like what you say there as well about whether it's good or not good, because that's just the start of the conversation. That's just the opening question, and then you delve off and look at varying different things. But whether it's good or not good is such a important thing to actually acknowledge. And also, of course, good to one person is going to be not good to the other. But I think, yeah, when you talk about purity and freshness and vibrancy and I like sense of place. I know perhaps some people don't value that as much as I, but I really like sense of place in a wine. I like cleanliness. I really like I like beauty. For me, that dictates what I think is good or not good. And then, yeah, it's a very incredibly complex conversation from there, and one that's become too dogmatic. Yeah, in recent times, unfortunately. But Rich and I have discussed this and many other things over many new vintages recently, and we've got a very very similar outlook, albeit different tastes here and there, but overall a very similar ethos. So it's going to be good for the future of 10 cases, I think.
And just breaking away from the bromance for 1 minute, and I love this wine. I think this is, you know, I'm guessing, you know, beauty and these things and aesthetics. You know, as soon as you pour this, it's just totally attention grabbing. It's a lovely bright color. It's, as you say, it has got the essence of summer, but there's a level of sophistication and there's a level of depth here that if you want to sit and talk about it and look for things and look for different notes, they're there. Really nice. 12.2%. I've just seen. Lovely. Really does a lot of things, I think. And yeah, great choice.
My choice for today, we've both gone red, which is not a testament. We both love white wine. We both love a lot of similar things, as you can probably tell from our affair that we're having at the moment. taking you to the northwest of Spain, to Bierzo, and this is a wine from the master of Mencia. Just may have coined that now. But yeah, this is Raul Perez's his village wine from Valtuil. This is Mencia Joven, but I mean, the area was forgotten for so many years, and so you've got this incredible, I think, to go there and see it, really shows that sense of place, and it really shows in the glass. You know, you're close to water, you've got influence from the Atlantic Ocean, all the rivers that run through there as well, but it's rustic and it's craggy and but very pure and pretty as well. And I think, you know, the local indigenous grape Mencia, I think, shows that. So you've got all these old vines of 100 plus years, and they've just understand the DNA of the land and of the vine, that I think just shows really well in the glass. But this is his sort of brighter, younger, unoaked example, which is just fun and a bit playful, but you know, it's got serious, you know, and it's not overly structured, but you know, it's just bright and juicy, and yeah, I love it. Love him. Yeah. Love him. Great, great beard.
Have you met Raul?
I've seen him from across the room. I'm going to record this conversation.
maybe better not to.
Great beard.
Would you like to add anything on about that? Or are you happy to?
Yeah, sure. I'm a big fan of the wines of Raul Perez as well, and this one in particular is just a really, it's got everything you want from just a juicy, young, fresh expression of a region and a varietal, and it's got great fruit and it's very pure. It's still got some nice brambly components and dried herb and I mean, they're very generic descriptors, but it's just got nice little touches of all of those components, which I really love, and it just draws you back to the glass as well. It's got that pure acidity and no oak influence. So yes, I'm a big fan of this wine, and Mencia as a whole, because it's quite slightly newer for me, having been brought up on a slightly more classical diet of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and things like that. So I've not explored Mencia prior to perhaps the last three, four years. I'd not tasted very often and not really taken it so seriously, but I'm just seeing it as one of the great grapes for the future, especially as the climate's changing and we're seeing people in this part of the world taking their viticulture and their winemaking practice much more seriously, and some real talent coming in there. And I think it's so exciting to I really can't wait to see what happens in the future. So
I love the descriptions you guys have just given, and I too completely love like Spanish wines, and I think Mencia is actually very important grape, just in terms of just letting people out there know that it's not just Rioja, it's not just Tempranillo, and there's a lot more that's out there, and I think the history actually of here has been where people have tried to over oak Mencia, and I, you know, completely agree with you, Richard. I just think the unoaked, just, you know, letting it show itself is kind of the way to go. And yeah, this is lovely. Really enjoying this.
So I'm very proud and excited and happy and sad and all the emotions to be finishing up here at 10 Cases and leaving London for that matter. I couldn't be happier that Rich is going to carry on in my position, and we've got such an amazing team here that I'm sure that the place is just going to go from strength to strength, and it's Will and Ian are so so fair and so open and so trusting as owner operators that I'm sure it's just gonna be fantastic. So I leave with a very heavy heart and a tear in my eye, but I couldn't be happier for where we're at, and I'm so proud of where we've come over the last little while anyway. But yeah, for me personally, I will be heading back to Australia. I want to connect with my family businesses, so the vineyard for one. That'll be the first thing, is go back and learn how to prune, because I've just ridden a bike around the rows, but never actually pruned. And now I've done other things, but yeah, pruning is one thing that I've never done, because it happens in the winter and it's very cold out there. But I really want to learn how to prune, so I'm going to do that's going to be the first thing I do, and I need to clear my head and chill a bit after this amazing London experience. And then the next step will be hopefully to connect with other parts of the business, and I really want to open my own and adopt a lot of the principles that I've learned in this city, which is such a great wine city. I really have absorbed a lot from Will and Ian, but I've got so much respect for what Michael's done at Zega and many other places. I just can't sit here and name them all, I really have a great I've absorbed a lot of knowledge and from just from seeing how these places operate in this massive city. And I think that I want to take components of these things back to Australia, whether that be Melbourne or Sydney, I'm not sure yet, but I look forward to opening a place down the track. So that I think that's the next step for me, and then potentially more vineyard work in between. But it's been amazing.
Thank you so much to the guys for appearing. I really feel like we captured a really cool moment in time. I've left the contact details below for the 10 cases and also for the guys. And I'd love to have you following along with me. I'm at Interpreting Wine on Instagram and Facebook, at Wine Podcast on Twitter, or email hello@interpretingwine.com. See you next time.